Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I am one of your co-hosts, Shobhana Xavier. I hope you are staying well and safe wherever you are, and thank you so much for joining us today. In today's episode, we are joined by Tina Prohit, who is an associate professor of religion, South Asian studies, and Islamic studies at Boston University to discuss her new book, Sunni Chauvinism and the Roots of Muslim Modernism, which is published by Princeton University Press and came out and will be coming out in May of 2023. Prohit's new book maps how Muslim modernists from the 19th to the 20th centuries used their Sunni bias to construct social and political boundaries around conceptions of Tawhid or Islamic unity. The book is distinctive in that it focuses on how Muslim modernists, such as Jamal al-Din Afghani, Muhammad Abdu, Rashid Bidda, and many others, were focused on communities such as Shi'is, Ismailis, Ahmadis, and Baha'is in their activist and intellectual projects around imagining a singular Islam in light of an encroaching Western modernism or modernity. For Muslim modernists who were anxious to reclaim a lost unity of Islam that perhaps existed in the past and could be aspired to again in the future, non-Sunni groups like Ahmadis for Muhammad Iqbal or esoteric groups for figures like Rashid Bidda became communities that received disparaging attention and even attitudes of intolerance that led to a particular Sunni chauvinism, Prohit argues. And as such, this obsession with unity and the privileging of Sunniism that went with it was found in all forms of modern Muslim modernism. This book will be of interest to those who think and write on modern Muslim modernism. It will also be a great teaching resource for undergraduate and graduate classes. It is really accessibly written and well organized. In our conversation today, Tina and I spoke about her intellectual journey that led to the writing of this book, particularly how some of the questions that she's engaging with are continuities from her earlier work on the Aga Khan case and religion identity in colonial India. And we spoke about the ways in which esoteric groups like Ismailis, Sufis are really receiving complicated attention from Muslim modernists such as Afghani, Abdu, Ridda, Maududi, and many others, and how those responses are at times framed as theological responses, but the more you dive into some of their writings, you note that they perhaps are really coming from places of personal anxieties, personal responses, or even, you know, moments of jealousy. So it's quite complicated. So without further ado, please check out our conversation about the new book, Sunni Chauvinism and the Roots of Muslim Modernism.
Hi, Tina. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me, Shobhana.
It's such a pleasure, and I'm really excited to talk to you about your new book, Sunni Chauvinism and the Roots of Muslim Modernism, which just came out. So congratulations to you. We have a tradition.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it hasn't officially, so May 16th is its official publication.
Okay, so it'll be out in a couple of weeks then, because we're recording this at the end of April. So this is like a nice little preview. This is awesome. But As you know, in the New Books in Islamic Studies Network, we have a tradition of asking a little bit about your intellectual journey. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what your journey was, and particularly what led to writing this particular moment, this book at this moment in your career.
Yeah, thank you. This is a really great time to reflect on some of the connections. I think, you know, with my graduate school into the first book and second book, because I can really sort of see a trajectory. Now it's more and more accepted these days. A lot of people are coming to Islamic studies via South Asia. And that's really where I was. And that was a little bit more unusual, you know, back when I was in grad school. But I felt like I had these two sort of parallel paths that connected with the first book. The first was my training in languages and literatures, Indian vernacular languages and literatures. And then in grad school, writing my PhD, I was really interested in the Bhakti movement, Hindu-Muslim encounter in particular. I was also, you know, at Columbia in the early 2000s, late 90s, and there was also a lot of subaltern history and South Asian history and historiography, and that was really taking off at the time. And so the first book that I wrote, The Aga Khan Case, Religion, Identity, and Colonial India, was really brought together these two sort of frameworks, the historical, historiographical one, as well as the religious encounter questions with the study of devotional literature. And that came together in the study of the Ismaili Muslim community in colonial India in the 19th century. And it was at that time that I was studying the Ginans, the religious texts of the Khoja Ismaili community, as well as, you know, trying to figure out like what was happening with all of their divisions and changes and shifts that were happening in colonial India at the time. And it was really during the 19th century where the Ismaili community became identified kind of formally and officially as a sect of Islam. And that had to do with a series of, you know, court cases in the Muslim community, amongst the Khojas themselves. And so the reason why I'm bringing all of this up, you know, this is my first book, is because I kind of conceptually got hooked on this term sect and was really curious about the ways that it gets used and applied in the study of Islam. And what are the ways in which it doesn't necessarily, its standard definition doesn't really map onto a tradition, you know, where we don't have in the history of Islam the equivalent of a church, and so therefore don't really have the equivalent of a sect. Yet it's a term that we use all the time, right? And so, and it's a term that that really was applied to the Ismaili community at that particular moment when the judge in a colonial court case known as the Aga Khan case decided that the Ismaili community, the Khojas, a caste group, were in fact the Ismaili sect of Islam, and used that language. So it was really at that time that I started to, you know, think about that question, like what is a sect? And then after the book came out in 2012, I started teaching and reading a lot more about the modernist movement. I got interested in the Aga Khan, the third Aga Khan, who was a big leader in the Muslim community, and some of his writings. But then I started teaching classes on modern Islam, and I became really drawn to the modernists, right? A particular group of political and intellectual leaders in the 20th and 19th centuries. And I started to like kind of look at reader after reader, Introduction to Modern Islam, modernist studies, all of these things. And there seemed to be this kind of canon of thinkers, right? It was like, and many of whom are in my own book, right? So Afghani, Abdul Rashid Rida, like this sort of Syed Ahmed Khan. And I always thought to myself, well, you know, somebody like the Aga Khan was actually a modernist leader too. Like, why don't his interventions make it in? So that was, you know, some of the starting questions for the book. And it really started about an interest in the modernist movement having to do with its occlusions, meaning some of the, like, why are some people left out on the one hand? And on the other hand, it had to do with some strange parallels that I was seeing when I was teaching about, let's say, Muhammad Abdu or Syed Ahmed Khan or Muhammad Iqbal. And I said, oh, there's this kind of a uniformity, this way in which they were talking about Islam, like Islam as unity, as a cohesive tradition. And so I was like, this is strange. This is happening in different geographic contexts. And so I started exploring some of those connections and some of the ways in which these modernists were writing about Islam as a unified tradition. So that's where it started.
That really is helpful, especially, and also makes sense in terms of some of the work that you do in the book, which I think is fabulous. And I think the piece on the Sunni bias and in terms of how these thinkers are thinking about, minority Muslim communities is really, really fascinating, and Ismailis show up a lot. So perhaps what we could do, there's a few pieces, moving pieces in this book, and in the introduction, you set up kind of the broader interventions that you're making. I wonder if you could help us think through some of these pieces. I know one is, as you've already mentioned, is the modernist thinker. So you're kind of engaging with the 1850s to 1950s. You have early, middle, late. And I think this wonderful thread that you're really helping us, like weaving cohesively, is this idea of tawhid, unity. How are they conceptualizing this idea of tawhid? And perhaps how is this conceptualization itself biased based on their Sunni perspective? So can you walk us through some of these pieces so then we can start talking about some of these figures that you're engaging with?
So I was trying to think about, as I said, as I started doing my preliminary research on some of these thinkers and some of their, the writings of what I call the canonical modernists. Those are the modernists who kind of, have been making it into all of the readers. So that would be like Afghani, Abdu, Ridha, Syed Ahmed Khan and Iqbal, right? So, I was reading around and reading in their writings, and I was trying to like look at some of the connections, and this word that kept reappearing in their writings as I would, read about their writings about Islam, was tawhid, right? And we, those of us in Islamic studies, obviously know what this means, and the Quranic idea of the unicity of God. But it rarely has that sort of meaning in their writings. And so what I was discovering is that more and more I thought that tawhid came to represent this idea of unity, but social and political unity rather than a sort of theological idea. Like even Muhammad Abdu, when he writes this piece called Theology of Unity, it's really interesting because he sort of introduces this concept, tawhid, and he says that this is, the idea of the unicity of God, blah, blah, blah. But he quickly moves into a very different kind of discussion, which is really about, the divisions and the sort of the fracturing of tawhid that is kind of, that is happening, in front of him. And so what I started to see is that, okay, that's just one example, but that tawhid sort of came to mean social and political unity, but it had a particular nuance, which was, and it's the term that I use in the book, a sort of bifurcated function. And what I mean by that is sort of like two different kind of ways, two different meanings. One is that tawhid existed in the past, a sort of like a perfect unified Muslim community, and that there's this potential for it to exist in the future, but it doesn't exist in the present. So tawhid has put social and political unity for these modernists, and I track this idea in their different writings, comes to represent this desire or almost an anxiety for something that doesn't exist, right? And so I talk about how tawhid is something that's understood as fractured, as something that needs fixing. And so there are two main components around tawhid, this bifurcated idea of tawhid, meaning like an ideal past and something to look forward to in the future, but not as in the present. There are two problems, according to these modernists, and one has to do with what they would like call accretions, right, to the religion. And again, I'm going to turn to Muhammad Abdu as an example. In that same piece, Theology of Unity, he talks about how there was this ideal period with the Rashidun caliphate. And then as we like track it, and then as time went on, slowly the community started to, like, you know, break apart. And, you know, and at one point he's like, what are all of these accretions? You know, what are all of these, you know, these new practices? And accretions are what? It's like that idea of the layering of new practices that have been artificially added on to the tradition and that need to be sort of pulled apart to capture that original unity, right? So social accretions that are religious practices that seem to deviate in some form from the original. And that's one source of anxiety around Tawhid. And the other is leadership. And, you know, I think in general, there is in the writings, there's this assumption that, you know, after the death of Muhammad, you know, there has never been a leader to sort of take over or, you know, there's a crisis of leadership, let's just say. And so there's a lot of writings about the anxiety of leadership. And that's where a lot of the criticisms come in of these other communities, the minority communities that I talk about in the book. And I think that is one kind of component of where the writings of these modernists, a lot of them share, is directing their anxieties towards these communities that actually have leadership. So that would be, for example, you know, the Ahmadis or the Ismailis. They start to become the sort of center of attention in terms of these more, in terms of the canonical modernist criticisms. And that's like another component. So Tawhid is really at the center of this discussion. And it really is what connects the different modernists that I study over this time period from the 1850s to the 1950s.
I really appreciated kind of the mapping that you did and the way that you weaved Tawhid together. And I just kind of was blown away. As you're kind of saying, a lot of it is presented as these logics and rationales, but some of them are just these personal anxieties and perhaps ego responses, like, oh, I don't have that attention the way that this guy has an attention. So therefore, I have an issue with this community. You know what I mean? And not to belittle it in that way, but I think it was quite humanizing to read the way that you mapped some of this concept across these different thinkers, right? That you're like, oh, it's not really a theological issue, it's a you issue.
Yeah, framed as a theological issue, but just definitely like political or just general kind of personal grievance kind of thing. Exactly. Or jealousy, let's just put it that way sometimes.
Exactly, jealousy. Yeah, I mean, well, talking about jealousy, we could start with Afghani as the kind of the first figure that you engage with in chapter one as like an early figure. And so you're doing an interesting work here, so you're really mapping this word, and I feel like I'm going to say it wrong. Is it Nicheri or Nicheri?
That's right. Yeah.
And so this writing and this word that he has that you're kind of mapping as potentially a pejorative or a derogatory term that he's using against maybe communities like Zoroastrians or Baha'is or Ismailis and some followers of Syed Ahmad Khan as well. And so how is this kind of, I guess, boundary is, you know, Afghani building this boundary around this particular word, which I think I saw in the book both translated as naturalist or materialist, I think we're, if I'm correct. But he was really using this word to have kind of a theological kind of boundary building around certain communities that he found perhaps, again, as you're saying, outside kind of the Sunni normativity that he's trying to build as like what constitutes a singular Islam.
Yeah. So Afghani is like the biggest mystery out of all of them in some way. He was such a chameleon and a politician. And as you could tell from that chapter, moved in so many different like political circles, to assume so many different positions, you know, in terms of, you know, in terms of what he was trying to angle for, the ways in which he was trying to angle for himself, right? So I think in some ways it's really hard to like read his argument as a theological polemic, right? Like that he really like takes issue, as if he like really takes issue on some sort of, you know, a theological Sunni. First of all, he's a Shia himself, right? And he sort of dissimulates that and covers that. But also like by way of the background, he was very much shaped by a lot of these, these kind of what I call esoteric traditions and was steeped in them, like in his formation. And even by the time that, you know, the time that he spent in Egypt, when he was part of the Urabi revolt, and he was really like, and he was part of these, like, you know, Masonic temples and lodges. And a lot of the language he was using was really drawn from, you know, some of these early kind of esoteric traditions of early Babism and early Baha'ism, and he was, and even a lot of early Islamism that he was you know, familiar with from his upbringing. So he was very much a politician, kind of using terms as he saw fit, you know, at certain times. But in terms of the time in India and the crazy polemic against Syed Ahmed Khan, right, in terms of like, where is this coming from and why is it so, like, you know, why is it so steeped in this kind of antipathy? It's interesting because, you know, this is a one-way thing. I don't think Syed Ahmed Khan, I don't think Afghani really registered, you know, who's that on Syed Ahmed Khan's radar at all. But you know, I think in that case, this long discussion, so I do that whole discussion of Nitcheri to first of all trace how that term, which is just a made up term anyway during that time, how he uses it against different communities, right? You can see he uses it against the, when in his arguments, he's like, listen, the Nitcheris have different sort of manifestations or permutations at different times in history. They're the, you know, they're the Zoroastrians, or they can be the Baha'is, or they're the Babis. And then at certain times he says the Bataniya, meaning referring to the Ismailis, but the modern Nitcheri, he says in this piece, the truth about the Nitcheris, that it are the followers of Syed Ahmed Khan. And you're just like, well, why, right? Like, why, how did this happen? And that's when I read some of those, when I read some of these, you know, and this material is all available. Nikki Ketty, who's a big scholar of Afghani, had written quite a bit about Afghani sort of aspirations, because also during this 19th century period, you know, there are people who are claiming are claiming positions of leadership around him. So, for example, the Sudanese Mehdi, right, who is a very prominent figure at the time, Afghani is kind of aware of him. And so when he's writing that Nitcheri piece and some other pieces he's writing in European journals and stuff, he's reflecting about this kind of political landscape, and really, I think, really looking for a place for himself where he can insert himself and be useful as a leader. So he makes these arguments about how, you know, the Muslim community in India, because I think he sees this as a sort of opening, is really in need of a leader, right? And he makes these arguments in the papers, and you know, they really could use somebody. And he doesn't really go so far as to say, hey, the leader should be me, right? Because one doesn't do that. You have to be sort of like diplomatic. But there are all these ways in his writings he's suggesting that, you know, that this wise person, this kind of this exemplary human being, leader, sage, right? These kinds of words, like the wise man, the Muslim wise man, kind of borderline prophet, but not really prophet, you know, because nobody's going to say they're a prophet. That he really sees himself as fulfilling that role as a leader of the community. And then it doesn't happen. So my argument there is that I read a bunch of different writings of his at different periods in different stages in his time in Egypt, while he's in Europe and writing from Europe, and then piece from India. And I track his sort of obsession with the Nitcheri and denouncing this community, but I really read it as, well, there's two arguments there, right? So one is that this is a theological argument. People said that. And then Nikki Ketty, who's a historian, she's already like kind of denounced it. She said, this is not really theological. This is a political argument, right? This is about Afghani making sort of political maneuvers. And I think that's right. But what I do add to that kind of discussion is I think that, you know, he has his sort of aspiration, and he does for leadership. And what he does is he denies and denounces the same communities that, in fact, whose ideas he appropriates. So that's the kind of double move that I'm sort of claiming about Afghani, is that, he uses a lot of the language from what I call these esoteric traditions, and we can talk about how that functions kind of conceptually for me, but he draws on that to sort of assert his own kinds of claims for authority and religious leadership while denouncing these particular communities.
And I think that's what's so fascinating in terms of mapping some of these figures' own personal histories and intellectual developments, is that they are coming from these really diverse contexts, so they were exposed to so many things, Sufism, esoteric thought, as you're saying. And so it's not like they're unaware of it. It's just almost that they know these traditions well enough to kind of have these responses. And I think you see something similar happening with Muhammad Abdu and his student Rashid Ridda in the next chapter as well, in chapter two, where they're really dealing again with this issue of Muslim unity. And I think there, again, there have these like kind of interesting responses to maybe the Baha'i faith or, and, some of them being sympathetic to some groups and not others. So even amongst them, so you would think of kind of Afghani, Abdu and Ridda as part of kind of similar trajectories. You see that they're kind of selectively deciding which community to kind of say, well, this is too transgressive for us based on this particular practice, but this perhaps, which also has a similar dimension of, let's say, continuing revelation or kind of an ongoing leadership, we're okay with this bit,
Can I just respond to that? And it has to go with about an overarching argument about modernism too, because to your point, what you were just saying is that, these modernist readers or these kind of handbooks on modernism, whatever we want to call them, that have like these sort of classical modernists, they will talk about them, these figures, in a lineage. And it's true, like the Afghani Abdu Ridda lineage, it's a lineage, right? But they are all so different, and they have all like negotiated, they all have different positions, especially and precisely around these minority and esoteric groups. And so my argument is that the study of modernism actually needs to be rethought via the esoteric and minority communities. Like, we cannot assume that standard lineage or that standard narrative anymore, because in fact, what we see are these very different positions, and that really the minority and the esoteric really has come to, we have to rethink the whole study of modernism based on that.
And I think it's a compelling, like I could see it in this book after having read it. Like, I understand that as a compelling argument in the work that you're trying to do. Did you want to talk a little bit more about Abdu and Ridda, what you're doing in that chapter in terms of like some of the responses to the Baha'is, for instance?
Yeah. So maybe if you don't mind, maybe before that, I'll sort of like kind of frame what I was, if Tawhid is one kind of big point, and that's a sort of kind of conceptual framing, I think the esoteric is another, right? And so that's where this plays out in this, where it plays out in this particular chapter. So what do I mean by the esoteric? Well, and why do I use it conceptually? I think that that really comes from wanting to find a way to talk about, it's sort of what you were just saying, in fact, it's that these figures are using language and discourse that's just familiar to them, around like Baha'ism or like Ismaili ideas or Shia ideas or Sufi ideas. That is all like in the air, and they're like using that, right? And what I mean, but also more specifically, it is part and parcel of the Islamic tradition, but it has been kind of written out by a Sunni normativity, right? That, that we don't really, we think about, and this is again the problem of sect, we think about Shia Islam as a sect of Islam, or Sufi Islam as a sect of Islam, or Ahmadis as a sect of Islam, or whatever it is, the Ismailis. And so we see them, but in fact, historically, they actually are part of the center. They're part of, fully integrated, part of what, somebody like Wilford Cantwell Smith calls, and I use in this book, the cumulative tradition, right? This is the cumulative tradition. Yet, we have to kind of separate the esoteric conceptually to get at some problems. Okay, so who are the esoteric? What are esoteric ideas or esoteric groups? In my book, or in my case study, I will call the esoteric groups the Ahmadis, the Ismailis, and the Baha'is, right? And they're very different. And some, there are a lot of debates on, especially the Baha'is and the Ahmadis, like where they fit within Islam. whether they are part of Islam, that kind of thing. But that's not the issue. The issue has to do with the fact of what do they share? Well, they share a history where there's a lot of language that developed around the hidden and inner meanings of the Quran. You know, the idea that there's something sort of like kind of mysterious, that knowledge, specialized knowledge about the Quran. There's ideas about prophecy that's continuous prophecy, that prophecy continues in some way after Muhammad, right, in whatever form. And they share that in terms of their beliefs. But what they actually kind of structurally share, all of these groups, are kind of their development of having established themselves as communities with leadership. Right, that they all have sort of leaders that are, and in this case, in the 19th and early 20th century, that are pretty active and successful. So you have Abdul Baha, and then you have, you know, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, and you have Yahya Khan, and you have the leaders of these communities who are actually like thriving, you know, and so I think the communities themselves are thriving, and they're thriving on the basis of this leadership, and so. The esoteric here has these two different components. One is that it's describing just literally these three groups, but it's also sort of trying to conceptually signal this kind of history and this past that is much more sort of mixed and, you know, for lack of a better word, non-Sunni. So going to the chapter with Abdul and Riza, it's really interesting because I start that chapter really with that reading of Theology of Unity that opens up, that again, is it seems like it's going to be about Tawhid because it's about unity, but it has to do with like social decline of the a history of decline of the Muslim community. And what's interesting about with somebody like Abdu is that, you know, he has these like very strong, this goes to your point about how they all have these kind of very crazy like positions with regard to these communities, and they're not really consistent with each other. So Rida really was a devotee and like disciple of Abdu, but very different in terms of his position. So Abdu was very sympathetic to the Baha'is. Right. And he had he was very much in awe of Abdul Baha and very much supported a lot of the work that was going on in the Baha'i community. In many ways, he was like a modernist. Right. He was very interested in the modernist programs. He was sympathetic to ideas of progressive revolution that Baha'is endorsed. And then it's interesting because in that dialogue that Juan Cole had translated between the two of them, that conversation between Riza and Abdu comes out, where you see Abdu's kind of sympathy for these communities. So it's but also not just the Baha'is, but also other groups like the Ismailis and also Sufis. Right. And then you see in that conversation, Riza going kind of berserk, like, how can you buy them? Like, they're just, and he uses the word propagandists, right? He calls them propagandists. And Abdu's like, you know, he has like his sort of like, you know, wise men sorts of responses and this kind of question. And what you see in that conversation is that they really diverge, and both of them have, you know, been seen in these kinds of histories of modernism as like, you know, canonical modernists of Egypt. You have, you know, you have Muhammad Abdu and his student Rashid Rida, and Rida kind of, you know, trains Hassan al-Banna, and then you get the Muslim Brotherhood. And then you have this kind of direct lineage as if, you know, these ideas are just transferred from one person to another. And they are in some ways. But what these discussions show is like this questions around who belongs and who doesn't belong. Are very charged, and somebody like Riza has really strong positions, and you know, I don't really know why. I mean, I reflect on it and I use some sort of theories that are out there, you know, in terms of his own positions and stuff, but so, you know, very different, of course, from Abdu and his sort of openness that he really brings and his generosity he brings in terms of his readings. But then on the other hand, what's strange about the Theology of Unity piece is he has this, the moment in which the decline starts, right, when he gives his account of like the Rashid Caliph, as soon as we get to the fourth Caliph, that's the period where everything gets broken. So he really attributes Shi'ism as like the moment in history where everything falls apart. Or, you know, once you have that, that's when the split and that's when all the fracturing, you know, starts. And so he does have his, I guess my point there is that he does have this sort of anti-Shia bias, but in that conversation, and you can see it very clearly in Theology of Unity, but in that conversation with Ritha, they're going back and forth and you see like, wow, he really is open and he's very much shaped by, and you can tell in his own writings, he's very much shaped by Baha'i ideas of like progressive revelation. People have, you know, their multiple revelations, they come at different times and, you know, and that sort of thing. And teachers, charismatic and leaders, that people can impart knowledge to the people and, you know, and that is possible. And that's what Rita just does not have any time for. You know, you cannot have a mediating role. You can't have a mediator. You can't have somebody between God and the people, right? And that's what Abdul is going on and trying to kind of convince him of, that it is possible.
Yeah, and I really, like, one of the things I really loved about this chapter is, like, Ritha's, like, he went to the Sufi gathering, the Mevlavi gathering, and he just, like, panicked and was like, screw this, and left. And I just was like, yeah. And so, again, I think it's, like, really interesting, like, this anxiety around leadership and also this anxiety around kind of continued revelation in some kind of esoteric mystical way or Bhatini like inner dimension way is just like not okay. And so part of it makes sense from a modernist perspective of like really negotiating with West and rationalism and all that stuff, I would imagine. But yeah, it is, they're almost always, I mean, in this chapter particularly, as someone who thinks a lot about Sufism, I could see that they're almost like trying to go to the edge of it, trying to really explore it. And then like, no, like, you know, this is not okay. Like, I got to get out of here. And again, it's not consistent across all of them either, right? Because they are leaning into it in some ways in terms of their own authority or their own kind of, you know, rationale or whatever, right? But it's like interesting for that to see the tussle of it in some instances. And it really came out really well with Sufism in this one, I found, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know, it was great. The next chapter, again, super fascinating. And again, this kind of really consistent kind of bifurcation, dissonance, kind of complication, but that's sustained, is with Muhammad Iqbal. And then this question of the Ahmadi beliefs and also Ismailis, right? And here on the one hand, the Ismailis are okay, or the Ismaili leadership of the Aga Khan is okay, because he represents this modernist, you know what I mean? Like a modern leader that is like, that I think they're craving for, that they want a leader. And again, following this kind of prophetic tradition of there will be a leader that comes to renew, you know, Islam. And so I think there's this like craving for leadership, but at the same time, you have something like the Ahmadis who also have leadership, you know, in this figure of a prophet, which is obviously theologically problematic for Sunni Islam. But there's like an argument here being made of like they're backward, whereas the Ismailis are progressive and modern. So I wonder if you could like help flesh out some of what's happening here with Muhammad Iqbal. I think the context is important. I think so, you know, what's happening in South Asia at this time, I think is also informing a lot of kind of these particular responses in some way. But yeah, again, back to kind of these minority, you know, Muslim groups who are on the margins and are really provoking these thinkers, right, in terms of who they're supposed to be and the normativity that they're trying to sustain.
Yeah. So Iqbal is, you know, gosh, so many people have written on Iqbal, right? And so people have actually, you know, a lot of people have written on this position of Iqbal, what he has to say about the Ahmadis, and clearly not the first to do this. You know, Aisha Jalal, Iqbal, Singh Sivia, Faisal Devji, these people have all like kind of reflected on this kind of where there's this like very anti-Ahmadi polemic come from. And again, I think Aisha Jalal would really say that it comes out of a sort of politics, sort of 1930s politics, where he's, you know, sitting on these different committees, and he's kind of, you know, working through his like political positions and things like that. And I think there's always like the, you know, there's a kind of a political, very obviously very active political landscape that's happening at the time. I think that, you know, the angle that I'm trying to go with in that chapter is really acknowledging that, you know, there is certainly, you know, a sort of a political positions and things like that. But it's really trying to get at what is it that just really kind of gets under the skin, like in almost in a, like a very kind of deep personal level, you know, because I think that we can all I would say the parallel would be, you know, the political readings that say Nikki Keddy gives about Afghani, right? That there's like the political motivations, which are not theological problems, these are politically motivated, right? So the guy should tell this is like politically motivated, these aren't like theological issues. And I agree with all of that. But I think that the layer I'm trying to get at in that particular discussion. I suppose, first of all, it's interesting because Iqbal's family had a very close connection with Mirza Ghulam Ahmad's family, right? So we know that there's certain members of Iqbal's family who had actually like taken the bayat of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad. And so, you know, it was in the mix, right? That he was in the mix, this figure in a very active religious sense. So there was that familiarity there already. But I think that, you know, the angle that, okay, so what am I bringing that's new to this conversation? I think that it's really this discussion of the backwardness, right? And I think that's what I was trying to like really get at in some ways, like what are the ways and what is the problem? And it really has to do with this idea of progress and modernity and, you know, and the community, again, the looking forward, if we take this idea of Tawhid and unity, the unity comes and he writes very, very beautifully on this idea of Tawhid. He's almost like the most poetic and the most like, you know, literal, like it's incredibly moving prose around this idea of Tawhid. But the function is the same bifurcation. We have this great Tawhid in the past and like we have this possibility in the future, but right now there is a problem. And the problem is that the community is divided. So where does Mirza Ghulam Ahmad fit into this? Well, he is really the problem, right? Or really a big part of the problem, because there are these people or leaders who are holding the Muslim community back, right? They are holding them back and they are preventing them. And so I analyze his writings and I especially talk about the accusations of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad being a Magian. So it's this idea of a past, like a superstitious past where, you know, people are a retrograde past where people are drawn to like these old practices or these backward practices. And he is somebody who's perpetuating that, right? That by this sort of devotion to him. So he makes all the standard arguments, like there can't be a prophet, you know, the sort of the end of prophecy and that sort of thing. But I think there's something a little bit deeper about the sort of modernist program and the modernist agenda that that he sees Mirza Ghulam Ahmad really kind of like bumping up against and holding the people back. And in the Aga Khan, the Ismaili comparison, it's really short. Right. I make it into a big discussion in my writings, but the whole piece is an anti-Ahmadi polemic that he writes that Leda Modudi picks up. But the piece of the Ismaili's kind of reflection is really something that he just tacks on at the end of that piece, where he's like, you know, some people say that, you know, they're all these groups out there that are doing this. And let me just tell you, this one group that people think that may be sort of remotely connected to the Ahmadis, let me tell you, they are nothing, right? And what's so nothing like the Ahmadis. And what is so interesting about that move, because that is some sort of like strange sectarian comparison that he's driving in his head to begin with. And then he reflects on all the ways in which the Ismailis and the Aga Khan endorse this sort of progressive Sunni Islam, and that they are so forward, you know, facing and looking like basically the direction of Tawhid. And so, you know, which is interesting, because there's this thing that I say in the book, which is like, I mean, the Aga Khan was very much like, you know, into integration and this sort of things. And he would never like, probably never have denounced, you know, or been so kind of polemical the way Mirza Ghulam Ahmad was in terms of his stance. He was much more integrative, you know, in terms of a public face. But it's what is so interesting is the way Iqbal completely misreads and distorts, really, Ismaili religiosity, right? Claiming that they may be Shia, or they may be doing this Twelver thing, or this Ismaili thing. But really, like, they endorse the five pillars and they're really just like one of us, you know?
And that was so interesting for me to read that they were like the keepers of Sunni Islam in some way. Like, he just kind of said it, like, nonchalantly and moved on. And I was like, wait, what?
And it's the closing, it's like the strangest thing is it's the longest piece, and it's like this last paragraph. It's like kind of like, by the way, kind of thing. And that's what I was really fascinated by.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely stood out for me. And I think this argument you're making of progress and modernity and the way in which the Aga Khan was facing in terms of his relationship with the British and all of this stuff and his policies of integration, there is an argument. I could see the argument here being very clear that there's something about the Aga Khan and the Ismaili case as like a progressive community that's very compelling to him. Whereas, you know, with the Ahmadis perhaps represent this other aspect, as he's, you know, saying it's backward. And so, yeah, it was like a really interesting kind of dynamic and logic to see unfold. And so it was really kind of stood out for me in this chapter as well.
And I think I would say like village, like backward and village, you know, right. And I think that's, you know, that's what it was. Like, these people are just very village, you know, and like, if you're going to get with the program, it's going to be something, you know, much more forward looking. But going back to that prophecy point, I mean, just, one thing I did want to say that we were talking about, and this is sort of a parallel with the Abdu chapter, is like how they're all kind of hitting up really close against Sufism, and then they push back, or, you know, and so that was the whole, just one of the big threads of his argument in that Ahmadi piece, where anti-Ahmadi piece, where he says, you know, it's not like I have a problem with people who are, you know, with people who have like prophetic experiences, you know, but so he talks about how his sort of sympathies for like, and he was very Sufi sympathetic, right? So it's interesting that in many of his ideas were very much shaped by Sufism, right? And that's why he really drew from that tradition. But when it comes to the Ahmadis, there's nothing Sufi yet. Like, for that, for him, it's like they're just a separate community. It's not like mystical, it's not esoteric. It's just sort of, it's just backward, you know? And so the Sufism for him is some sort of like, you know, kind of cerebral, intellectual, kind of high tradition, and that he's drawn to and he's sympathetic to, and he's interested in playing around with ideas of prophecy, but not the sort of, not the continuous prophecy leadership claim that somebody like Mirza Ghulam Ahmad makes.
It makes me wonder how much there's like a class bias that he's not aware of. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of thinking about what's unfolding, that he himself is perhaps, you know, subconsciously projecting onto what looks like progressive, a way of life, which is kind of this, you know, ideas of particular perceptions and modernity of how one dresses and how one shows up versus like how he's, you know, associating village life to not being progressive because of a particular class bias. But yeah, it's really unfortunate.
Definitely the most, because he did his PhD in Europe, he was definitely the most cosmopolitan of all of the modernists. I mean, certainly, you know, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, I think he, you know, barely spoke English, right? But somebody like Iqbal did his PhD like in Europe, and, you know, very, I mean, because all of the canonical modernists were very European, Europe facing and informed, but he really like did it, you know, did his PhD there and was informed by all of the, you know, history of you know, Nietzsche, Bergson, and, you know, Spengler, and all these people are like informing his writings, you know, so much more, most cosmopolitan, I would say, of all of them.
So interesting. The last substantive chapter before kind of a concluding chapter is on Maududi and the Islamic State. This was really interesting because you also do bring in Said Qutb as well. And there's like this interesting tension that you're mapping out with modernism and Islamism, right? Which I wasn't expecting because, you know, we were going towards kind of late modern thinkers. And so, yeah, here the question is really of an Islamic State and who fits within the Islamic State according to Maududi. And of course, a lot of this stuff is also something Said Qutb is thinking about in the context of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood. But yeah, so How would you perhaps, what are you trying to do here in terms of setting up these two figures, but also particularly helping us think about maybe like the relationship between modernism and Islamism, if I kind of, I'm picking that up correctly.
Definitely. That is really the kind of question, because I, again, going back to sort of classic definitions and breakdowns, and we have, you know, modernism and then Islamism, right? Like kind of two different ideas related, and you know, and one building from the other. And all these people have like written on that, Yubin, Marcus Yubin, Saman, all these, you know, people are talking about Islamism as a different type of movement in many ways. And it is, I completely agree. The only reason why I wanted to situate Maududi as a modernist, or what I would call late modernist, is because I wanted to sort of look at the continuity of ideas and how they developed, and how we see some of the same kind of formulations at work even as we move into the Islamist moment. So going back to the Tawhid idea, I track it in Maududi's writings as kind of, again, functioning pretty much the same way as it had functioned, you know, with the earlier modernists, as having this sort of like bifurcated cast. So turning, looking towards the past and then looking towards the future, and then the present being sort of, you know, fractured or broken. The difference, of course, in the late modernist, or what we would call Islamist period, is that the state is very much at the center of and a new concern. And that's how we would like think about late modernism and distinguish it from, let's say, the middle period, where somebody like Iqbal or Rashid Rida are not really, I mean, they're thinking about the state, definitely. They're thinking about nationalism, let's put it that way. Whereas the earlier modernists are not, right? They're not like Afghani, even Abdul, not like really thinking about the state and nationalism. But what we have by the late modernist period are these figures who are really focused on the nation state, because they are living in a moment where the nation state is emerging, right? It's decolonization in Egypt. It's 1947, right? Maududi tracks it's the transition and the creation of Pakistan, so it's pre and post. So the nation state is very much at the foreground. And so this idea of Tawhid really becomes actualized with these later writers, in the form of the state. And so when that happens, the sort of boundaries become charged in a new way, defined in a new way, because you can actually have nation state boundaries. You can decide who is within, who belongs within, and who belongs outside the nation. And so what I do with the MD issue is trace that logic that gets started with Iqbal. I even look at how Iqbal's writing, some of Iqbal's thinking gets picked up in Maududi's writings, and how, but yet Iqbal doesn't talk about, you know, the national belonging, right? He talks about the entities as a community, not necessarily like whether they are, you know, a minority or a majority of the state. And so where that question gets picked up with Maududi in a new form, because the state is very much at the center, and, you know, actually newly formed. And so it's really easy to say, okay, well, Pakistan is a Muslim state, Muslim country, and then, you know, if Ahmadis are not Muslim, like, what does that mean, right? And then we have this idea of nation state belonging. But the other parallel that I try to trace back with Maududi to the other modern, and that's also why I want to put him in the modernist a little bit, or kind of draw connections with this, with the earlier modernist, is again the leadership aspirations. So he's another figure who Afghani kind of talks about how there's this need for a Mahdi, right? And you know, as somebody who's gonna revolutionize, you know, society, and, you know, and then he sort of writes about what this person would look like, and how this person would be a modern man, not really a traditional man, and would respond to the needs, and all of these things, like sort of like, you know, open, like kind of suggesting without making explicit, like, hey, look who's a real contender for this like leadership position. So that's another kind of phenomenon I was sort of trying to introduce with Maududi in terms of, that's why I was trying to bring much more, because he's always been seen as a sort of like as a foundational Islamist thinker and then shaping Qutb and all of that. But I wanted to look at that, some of those aspirations, leadership aspirations that sort of get laid out there. That was part of why I wanted to make those connections to the earlier modernists. So I'm not trying to say Maududi is a modernist and not an Islamist. I don't want to make that argument. I just wanted to, like, that's not that important or interesting. It's to say, like, let's just see some of the continuities to these other people that I'm looking at.
And I think that's so helpful because I think one of the important contribution, at least for me, or what I found useful about the book is precisely this broader genealogy, like a bigger picture, as opposed to, I think we're so used to studying these figures in silos sometimes. And so it's helpful to kind of use actually a thread, like a conceptual thread, like Tawhid, and map it through and see how they're engaging and responding.
Well, that's been one of the kind of questions from, you know, like to sort of, I don't know if this is the right medium to say something like this, but it's like, you know, people say, well, what are your original sources? Well, I can't really say, I'm not unearthing new archives. And these are classical treatises and texts that all of these thinkers have actually written about. I don't have all this new material that I'm unearthing or anything like that. I'm just kind of like putting them together in a conversation, putting them together in a way to create a conversation and track these comparisons that hasn't been done before to make an argument, you know? So like I thought, you know, going back to just the intellectual journey piece of things, I mean, when I first started writing this book, I thought it was a book about modernism. And so when I was workshopping it and sending out to people, like, this is about modernity in Islam. And then the, you know, people like publishers said, well, not really, you know, this is because like what that's too big and doesn't necessarily, you know, so I was kind of flipping around quite a bit. And then finally I was like, oh, wait, no, I'm trying to make an argument. I'm trying to like make a new kind of argument based on classical thinkers and classical pieces that everybody knows.
Right. Yeah. No, I think it's just like this mapping that you've done for us. Like you've been, you know, swimming in all of this, you've mapped it out for us. And it's really an opportunity for the reader to kind of deep dive and think through and like treat these as individual people, treat these as humans in their social and political context, but also think about how they're contributing to this bigger idea, which I think really is important to, you know, and I love it because of the idea of Sunni chauvinism. I think that's a great kind of, you know, framework of thinking about some of the boundaries and responses to transgressions that are being constructed here, right? And I think that's so important. And as someone who thinks a lot about Sufism, I think this is what was really compelling for me about the book is like thinking about why are these figures so much heated response to Sufism or any kind of esoteric movement? Like, where is that coming from? And so to kind of see that play out, at least for me as a reader, I was like, oh, like, you know, it got me thinking. And so I really appreciated like the responses to Ibn al-Arabi or like, why are they having this issue with this particular institutional structure of Sufism? And from a modernist perspective, yeah, I could see why that's working out, right? Or why it's playing out, even though some of these figures are coming from Sufi families or Sufi adjacent families or were exposed to Sufism by an uncle or a teacher or whatever, right? And so I think those are the details that I found particularly compelling and fascinating for me to have it all together in one space. So the last chapter is a really interesting chapter and it kind of shifts towards kind of the post-colonial context. It's like, I think a broader conclusion to the book as well. And you're thinking about like Fazlur Rahman, Great Isaac, Ali Shariati, and really thinking about how they are approaching ideas of Tawhid, but from a place of ethics. Like anti-oppressive ethics, as I'm thinking about Fareed Isaac in the South Asian context, or Ali Shariati and kind of his response to Iran and a Marxist kind of, you know, response to some of the things that are happening in Iran, or Fazlur Rahman. So I'm really curious for one in terms of where this final chapter was coming from in terms of who was serving, because obviously I think it makes sense, but I'm like curious about, you know, what it is that you wanted to do maybe as an intellectual process for you to end off on this chapter for the reader, you know, if that's an okay question to ask. I'm actually asking out of curiosity and nothing more. Yeah.
You know, I don't, the concluding chapter is, it was something, it's interesting because it, yeah, it doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't have that sort of like that tight kind of parallel. I feel I was able to kind of connect from chapter to chapter, but like Tohi was doing this particular thing and it's like operating in the same, because clearly these figures that I'm choosing at this particular moment are all like in different contexts and they're in different kind of places. And the Tohid is getting, so okay, so there are a couple of things that I feel I was trying to do with this chapter. One is that I was trying to say, look, I haven't exhausted, I'm not, the point is that Tohid is not functioning in just this one particular sociopolitical way. It has these other, you know, as anxiety or as unity, whatever, it has all of these different sort of, it has this later history, right, in terms of what it's doing. And some of it is inflected by Shiism and Shi politics, as is the case with Ali Shariati, right? So it's like taking different threads of what Tohid was doing earlier and like picking up and just kind of like ruminating on what some of those, the afterlife and the aftermath might be. So one has to do with this sort of the Shi'i kind of permeates, right? Because the point in the earlier chapters is that it's Sunni chauvinism and there's a Sunni normative bias, but here we say, wait, hold on. We have a kind of specifically Shi kind of co-option of this term in the case of Ali Shariati. We have the South African sort of anti-apartheid struggle of a Muslim minority community that's kind of using this term in a particular way, you know, you know, again, also ethics, like this idea of ethics and justice. These are the sort of questions that I feel like are animating the post-colonial situation, right? In terms of how do we make sense of the world in these different contexts. So these are just sort of like just little slivers here and there. It's like, what are the sort of vestiges and what are the remnants of that idea and what kinds of what has sort of developed since then? So it was just a chance to give a sort of reflection. So I did the piece on South Africa and then a little bit on Iran and then a little bit even in like Fazlur Rahman's writings. And then I looked at how, in fact, he too carries some of that, you know, anti-Bataniya kind of thinking and stuff like that, you know, that still that still continues. And then I guess the part about Al-Qaeda was almost the little bit of the risk there, because I was looking at the term Tohid in the writings of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And the point there is to say that, look, and that too, I think in some ways could be understood as a quote unquote ethical project. But that the term Tohid and all of its permutations, I think it started off as something aspirational, started as something about justice and that some of that, you know, making a corrective of some kind, right, for the modernist, let's make things right through Tohid. And I think that continued in the post-colonial period with these examples. But then it also had this reactionary turn, right, with a group like Al-Qaeda, where this idea of Tohid as unity, you know, very much like anti-Shia, which we see later in the sort of, like, if you take the aftermath of something like Al-Qaeda into ISIS, right, because you have really anti-Shia stuff. So that idea of Tawhid really continues as social and political unity, but it moves in different directions and it has different sort of projects and orientations and reasons that animate that justice, right? So that justice, I feel like, or that ethical kind of impulse was always there, and then it just takes on a different kind of course and meaning. And so that was just a chance to like reflect on the different angles, I suppose, in the post-colonial period that were not taken up in the chapters, you know, at the heart of the book.
Yeah, and I think it could be the next book if you want to, the entire, because I think, yeah, you could easily dive into each of these figures and really kind of do what you did with the other figures as well. Fantastic. I know I took a lot away from it, and I know our listeners will too, and I'm sure the readers will pick up and have like a really interesting engagement with it. As we're wrapping up, I mean, is there anything that perhaps we didn't get out in the conversation or anything you want to say in terms of as a concluding point of the takeaway for the book for our listeners?
I guess just, you know, just chauvinism doesn't really come up in the book, the word itself, more Sunni normativity. And so it was an interesting title term. It also seems like a little retro, you know, like we haven't heard that term chauvinism in a while. But I think I just want to think about it as a perspective, right? Which is to say, you don't have to be Sunni to be Sunni chauvinistic, right? Afghani was not Sunni, he was Shia, but he had a Sunni chauvinistic position when it came to certain things. And so I think that chauvinism can manifest itself in terms of, you know, ethnic chauvinism or different kinds of biases that I just wanted to highlight as more of a perspective than the literal Sunni, you know, Sunni theological idea. Let's put it that way, more of a perspective.
I think it's a catchy title. I think it's great. Yeah, I love it. And the cover's great as well. I know this book is not even out yet. Like, it's out in a couple of weeks. And so I'm asking about what's next. Hopefully you'll have lots of time to celebrate and people will be engaging with this and you'll have some break, obviously. But are there things you're thinking about maybe as next projects or things that you're
working on? Yeah, I am. I have a project underway. No, I don't have a project underway. I have a seeds of a project that I'm just thinking about that I hope to start this summer. And it's probably kind of, in some ways, kind of a continuation of some of a thread that's been running through book number one and number two, which is I'm really interested in the figure of Ali and Ali's piety, I suppose, in general, and the ways in which that sort of, I guess what I'm calling it right now is Ali's charismatic hero, and I'm interested in the sort of porousness of the Ali devotional framework and how it moves, coming back to where I started, in different, you know, Hindu or Muslim and different communities across South Asia and the Middle East. And so I'm interested in that figure and the sort of different devotional frameworks and the sort of porousness of him and devotion towards him. So I'm going to be like exploring that, I think.
I love that. I'm like a South Asianist at heart too. So when I hear like stuff like that in devotional practice, I think that's amazing. I'm excited. And when it comes out, hopefully we can have another chat about that as well. But
10 years from now.
Minimum. Okay. Well, don't worry. You don't have to hold each other to it, but I look forward to the book when it comes out, with or without having to have a conversation on the network. I'm so grateful that we got to connect. I really learned a lot hearing from you and talking about this book. And I hope our listeners did as well. Thank you so much, Tina.
Thank you, Shobhana. Thank you for your great questions.
And that was my conversation with Tina Prohit about her new book, Sunni Chauvinism and the Roots of Muslim Modernism. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, take care.